Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you one English bishop's experience of Iran. The next in our series to mark half a century since the election of Blessed Pope John the 23rd. And our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by sharing with you one English bishop's experience of an overwhelmingly Muslim country, Iran. He's the Archbishop of Liverpool, Patrick Kelly, also Vice President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And he recently returned from Iran, where he celebrated Mass with the Christian communities in this nation's capital, Tehran, also giving two lectures on the theme of interreligious dialogue to the Iranian Institute of Philosophy in Tehran and the Centre for Religious Studies in Qom. But as I discovered when he sat down with me here in our studios, he's visited this nation not just once. Listen to my first question then. Was it a meeting of thinkers, sharing insights at academic level?
This one was at that level, but it arose out of something much simpler. A request was made by the Latin Church in Tehran if we could somehow accompany them in their very unique journey, which they make as a very, very tiny group of people in a country which is largely Muslim. And so that was the first reason to go, but since then there have been visits to many wonderful places.
When did you go exactly, can I ask you?
5 years ago, I think, was the first visit, and I've been four times now altogether. Perhaps the most moving was the first, when it just happened that 3 or 4 days before we arrived, there'd been the earthquake in Bam. So we were able to go there, and I saw for myself the devastation, and able also to celebrate Mass with some of the Christians who were part of the relief effort. That was a special searching privilege, and I don't think I'll ever forget it. A year later, very different, I went to Tabriz in northern Iran, mainly to visit this one of the sisters, the Daughters of Charity we'd met in Bam, who was back to her day job, if you like, caring for lepers. And we visited the leper colony in Tabriz, and it was truly remarkable. There are three Daughters of Charity, a French priest who was also a surgeon, and a Charles de Foucault brother. They've been there over 30 years. They have never nursed a single Christian, never received anybody into the church. And yet, for me, it was the most wonderful expression of church I've ever seen.
Don't they feel a bit isolated there?
Somehow they don't. I think partly because, which I think is always the way, by their sheer goodness and their skill, because they are very, very skilled in what they offer, they've won the respect of the community. When I ask the question, how do you survive financially? It's very simple, but you need money. And it was explained, oh, when we need anything, we just sort of mention it and whatever we need arrives. If the roof is leaking, we mention it and somebody comes and repairs it. So clearly, they've won the respect of all those around them. The other very precious moment for me, when I asked, where do your patients come from? They simply said very quickly, from Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan. But in the same way as if you said to somebody here in the hospital of Santo Spirito, from near to where we are now, where do your patients come from? They might say, from the Janiculum, from the Centro Storico, from the Palatine. They use those words as if they were just districts of one region. And I realised again the complexity of that whole part of the world. We name countries. There are countries, but there are, if you like, the barriers are broken down in many ways by different relationships across families and memories and tribes. It was one of those precious moments.
When you travel to these places, it's really about listening to understand, isn't it? I mean, even yes. in this case, it was listening. To these
I always,
Sisters of Charity
yes.
and this Charles de Foucault
yes.
brother.
And I always say, I come back less foolish. I would never claim to come back wise. It is so complex. And again, on a later visit, I was able to go to Persepolis, the palace of Darius the Mede, and all of a sudden, parts of the Bible, which I've known for years and years, leapt into life. We saw the tomb of Cyrus and this extraordinary place of Darius and the Mede, and we talk about the laws of the Medes and the Persians, and all of it comes alive. But when you see that huge, huge city built of sandstone, you realise how humble we must be. These were being built when my ancestors in Ireland and England were perhaps catching the occasional trout if they were lucky. And there was a civilisation with art, with buildings, with architecture, with huge structural skills. Mm. On the monuments you see signs of musical instruments and you think, we'd better not go proudly here.
Symbols of animals, too.
The animal symbols, they struck me very strongly because...
The bull, the eagle.
The eagle and the lion.
The lion.
But what struck me is the animal that isn't there is the lamb. And I realised then the wonder of the final book of the Bible, which many people find difficult, but I've always felt is one of the most important, the book of Revelation. And that has the symbols of the big beasts, but it says in the end it all belongs to a lamb slain. And there you realise the difference between what our Lord would call Satan's kingdom and his way, which is a very, very different way indeed. And I didn't understand the symbols till I saw those huge carvings of the mighty animals, then thought, but there's one that's not here that is central in our final book. Not a lion, not an ox, but a lamb.
Persepolis, for our listeners who haven't seen it, is near Shiraz,
Shiraz
which
yes.
is near this where wine was invented.
Exactly, amazing. That's another irony. But also, Shiraz itself is also a place of poetry.
Of Hafiz
and we went to this place. That's right. We went to the gardens, and there were people gathering. Well, instead of going out to become drunk on beer on Saturday night or whatever night, the people came to imbibe poetry in big numbers.
Mm.
Wonderful.
From the tombs of the poets.
Absolutely. Very special.
I was getting back to Persepolis. It's,
yes.
it's just outside Shiraz.
Shiraz, yes.
And it's like an empty space.
Base, that's yes. right, with a huge platform built in the desert to receive the tribute of the nations.
Do you want to explain more about some other journeys?
The next one, after that, we visited, as if in a sense like tourists, the museum in the holy city of Qom and their library. But then there was a discussion with some of the mullahs. And without my expecting it, one of them said, would you return to give us a lecture? We've been talking about quite serious issues, and I said I would certainly consider it. So this year I deliberately went back and gave two lectures, one there in Qom, in the Holy City.
Qom is the Holy City, which is considered to be the centre of formation and spirituality
right,
of Iran.
That's right. So I was asked to give a lecture there, and another one at the Faculty of Philosophy of Tehran University. The interesting thing for me is that I followed the advice of a very shrewd scholar of the Middle East in England, Mark Allen, and he said, do not try to make comparisons between what you say and what may be the Muslim understanding. Just speak from deep within your own tradition. So that's what I did. I think it's a good sign. At both places, they said, will you come back next year, but come a few weeks later, so Ramadan is over and the students are back, because we'd like the students to hear you.
You mentioned that you visited the library, which has an extensive collection of Islamic literature. It's
absolutely
very famous, isn't it?
Very, very. It was truly fascinating, though I think, fascinating as it was, there's another one only 300 yards from us where we are, the Vatican Library. It certainly is ancient, and it has, again, that's a marvellous library, but still we were very very warmly welcomed and shown many marvellous texts and all carefully preserved and cared for. It was good.
Qom is quite famous. I've never been there. Can you describe it to me?
The complicating factor is it's become a huge, sprawling city.
It's close to Tehran.
It's about 50 kilometres, I think, from Tehran. And then you have some very beautiful small ancient parts, but quite small. And then on the outskirts, they built this new centre for religious studies, and that's where I gave the lecture. Perhaps most noticeable are the number of mullahs, obviously, because it's a school of learning. And so that's more noticeable than, say, in Esfahan or Shiraz. And some parts are reserved for men only. Parts of the city are reserved in that sense, and that's, but of course you find that in many of the mosques as well.
Can we talk about the culture in Iran? The Christian culture goes back centuries, doesn't it?
It does.
Talking about an overwhelmingly Muslim country, and where 1% are Christians.
Of the population, that's right, and of that a small percentage are the Latin,
Catholics.
Yes. So you've got
most
that
are Orthodox, I believe?
Mostly Orthodox, and you've got the Armenians as well. And many of the people in the community, of course, are first or second generation immigrants. We are so used, I suppose, to what you might call a closed Iran, we forget that both in the days of Mossadegh and the Shah, it was a fairly open place where many people went because there was huge business opportunities, not least in oil and all the related industries. So many people from Europe went to those countries, and a significant number of the Christian community are in fact coming from those days of immigration from Europe. So, for example, I celebrated Mass there in Italian and in French in Tehran, and in French and in English. I couldn't celebrate in Farsi anyway, but the demand was for those languages. There's now a significant Japanese community as well, and Filipino community. I know the Archbishop of Esfahan, Archbishop Bedini, explained that when we went to Tabriz and when we went to Shiraz, and they involved journeys by plane of an hour and a half, he said, "Don't forget, you're still flying over my diocese." Which is very healthy for a bishop whose diocese is 50 kilometres by 40. It puts me in my place, I think. My own diocese is about the size of Tehran in area.
There are other Christian initiatives like schools and cultural centres and newspapers and things like that.
There are, but it's a very delicate area, and certainly the schools are finding their space for manoeuvre is perhaps not what it once was. Very clear differentiation between the academic and questions to do with faith, religion. And I think one of the problems, but it's not unique to Iran, I think it touches Europe, is this whole question of freedom of religion. I applied to my own country that from 1794 Roman Catholics had freedom of worship in England. They could have churches and so on. But it was 1825 before full emancipation, which meant you could, while being known to be a Catholic, seek to become, for example, a Member of Parliament. And the basic understanding was that when you went to Parliament, you were allowed to take part in all debates. The problem in many countries is that where you have people of the minority faiths or religions in Parliament, they are only invited to discuss issues precisely to do with their own community. Now, freedom of religion is a much broader thing than that. It should mean the space to be involved in all issues to do with the well-being of every man, woman and child. The difficulty, of course, is, and we've got to be quite honest about it, as we always say, what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. We have got, if we say this, then we've got to think through the questions of, for example, Muslims becoming members of our governing bodies and taking account of at what level are they involved in debates about every issue to do with society. It's not an easy path to tread, but it's not helped by simply saying if you say it's easy, then you're in dangerous territory. I think it's much better to think through what these things mean.
Well, how would you describe then how Christians are viewed in Iran in general?
For example, I wore my clerical dress all the time. I never felt anything but respect. In terms of possibility of being involved, for example, in debates on everything to do with society, that seemed to me to be rather restricted. There didn't seem to be the space which we would give to, for example, in my own country, to Muslims. There didn't seem to be that space. And when new buildings are needed, though again we've had some very lively debates in England about where, for example, a mosque or temple shall be built, I think there is more space for them in England than would be for Christians in Iran. And then you've got also to keep in mind the subtle problems about how we are perceived. The recent wars have not helped. And then the whole complexity of the Iraq-Iran war and who was arming whom and who was helping whom in that conflict. There are all sorts of quite bitter memories that need to be considered. And now, of course, you've got the ongoing conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, which, because of that example of how they see themselves, touches them all, not just those two countries.
Can you tell me something that you found incredibly positive about Muslims and their faith there?
Just their fidelity. To see Ramadan makes me think, and we barely keep Fridays anymore, but their Ramadan, the rigorous fast from sunrise to sunset, so all food outlets are closed in Tehran while we were there during the daylight hours. The sheer numbers, and again a very delicate area, but it has to be said, the men going to the mosque, and we were there on the Friday when the Supreme Leader was speaking at Friday prayers, and they were in their thousands going to the university where he spoke. And the day we left, we thought we'd have a clear run to the airport at 2:30 in the morning. Planes coming back tend to leave at strange hours. We got in problems because it was a martyr's day, and at that hour there were thousands heading to one place where they were going to remember this martyr. This was in the early hours of the morning.
You were listening there to the Archbishop of Liverpool, Patrick Kelly. And now moving on in the broadcast, for the third time in a row, in a very personal manner, I'd like to mark the 50th anniversary of the election to the papacy of a much-loved pope, one once known as Good Pope John, and since the year 2000, Blessed Pope John. For the record, Angelo Roncalli, who was elected as successor of Peter on the 28th of October 1958. I'll be doing this in a moment by dipping into our Vatican Radio archives. So get ready to listen to this Pope's voice once again, as well as to testimonies from some of those who knew him. Testimonies I personally collected over the years. Stay tuned. Prisoners cheering, drowning out the voice of Pope John the 23rd as he speaks to them behind the bars of a Roman prison. It was Christmas 1958, and in an unprecedented gesture, a pope was standing in their midst offering them words of comfort. "When you write home," he said, "be sure to tell your families the pope has been to see you."
La prima lettera che scrivete adesso a casa vostra deve portare la notizia che il Papa è venuto in mezzo a voi e che vi promette, anche lui dice il suo rosario e quindi fa passare bene i grani della sua corona, dice la sua messa.
You could come to see me, so I came to see you. It wasn't just going to the prison, but it was his manner in the prison. You know, the way he greeted the prisoners, and in his talk right away he said, "Listen, I know it's tough in my own family. One of my cousins ended up here too."
At the time, Father Redemptus Vallerbeck was a young Carmelite seminarian in Rome. He recalled the enormous impact of John the 23rd's visit to the prison.
So right away there was that personal with the prisoners. You could see some of them in the pictures, you know, crying that that the Pope would come to see them, which had never happened before.
Nobody had ever gone to the prisons like that on Christmas Day. I mean, he thought of, you know, the little ones in hospital and the people in prison. He didn't respect the protocol. I mean, he went straight at it. If he wanted to talk to somebody, he would talk to them.
Didn't it irritate the Vatican?
I mean, I don't know. I wasn't on that side of the war.
But, you know, I mean, weren't there critical comments about this in the newspapers at the time? You know, what's the Pope doing? Or...
I don't remember critical comments at all because...
When the Pope visited the Bambin Gesù Children's Hospital, Jill Tyler was a young journalist in Rome, reporting for the most popular British Catholic newspaper.
There were no sort of comments about the political ways of doing things or anything like that. It was always, it was just that he went to the people.
Io sono venuto qui, come vedete, in perfetta condizione di salute. Non proprio pronto a fare una corsa, entrare in una gara, ma insomma però per misurarli quella comune, ecco.
Suddenly you had this Pope who acted out of instinct, who said what was on his mind, who responded to people. I mean, they say the first time he went to a hospital, Bambino Gesù here in Rome, the children all started screaming, Pope, come here, Pope, come here, Papa, vieni, vieni, you know, come here. And he said, okay, the Pope is coming, the Pope is coming, I'm coming to see you. It was just, it was a natural instinct on his part. And it was so astounding. It was, he, you might say, to some degree, that he restored some of the pastoral dimensions of the papacy.
Historian Father Paul Robichaud of the Paulist Order grew up in the United States during John the 23rd's pontificate.
They must go back to your childhood, I think, John the 23rd.
Well, I was in grade school when Pope John the 23rd became Pope in 1958. I was just 10 years old. I remember a few recollections because television was something very new in my family. And so the idea that you could actually see something about the election of a pope on television, and that the warmth that this pope exuded, and what came with that warmth were all of these, this great excitement about the church, and that things were somehow changing in the church. And so during the years of his pontificate period, where I was going from the age of 10 to the age of 15, going through adolescence, rebellion, and so I'm sure to some degree that the changes that the church brought about by the calling of the Vatican Council probably were reflective of some of my feelings at the time and made the church more interesting and exciting. But I think more importantly was this incredible sense of his warmth and his presence and how it seemed to be impacting on my parish, my school, the parochial life that surrounded me, and how things seemed to be less rigid and personal and engaging. And so the very personality of the Pope seemed to come all the way down to my local parish somewhere and express itself in a lot of warmth and care.
Della luce va a portarla in santa pazienza, in pazienza un esercizio. E poi, precisamente, lo spettacolo, spettacolo della carità.
When we saw the Pope, and we saw him really as friendly, as simple, maybe a misleading word, because he was a very intelligent person and he was much deeper than people thought.
Nigerian-born Cardinal Francis Arinze was in Rome studying for the priesthood at the time. He felt Papa Roncalli played a key role in giving life to the missionary church.
He called Vatican II and prepared for it. It's no act of just a simple person. It's rather deep, but very friendly. He makes you feel at ease. And even when he visited our college in Propaganda, as we were then urban, Collegio Urbano di Propaganda Fide, I remember a phrase he used. I think he said, our two hills look at one another and understand each other. That is the Vatican Hill and the Janiculum Hill, because Collegio Urbano is on the other hill, immediately overlooking the Vatican. So we liked him, and it was in his pontificate then we were ordained priests, and we were very happy to have such a pope. He loved the mission church, and he showed it by the way he treated the mission college, by the way he treated the mission bishops. Indeed, from that time, the number named bishops in the mission countries increased at a very fast rate.
The first thing he did is he suddenly empowered a whole new generation of church leaders. He created, for consistories, a whole new college of cardinals. He invited the bishops of the world to come to Rome for an ecumenical council. And where originally the Curia controlled the original agenda for the council, and that turned around, he eventually empowered all of these bishops to move. So one of the things that's very interesting is, even though he appears non-collegial, or someone who's very decisive and single-minded in what he did, he was the great facilitator.
Pope John the 23rd was very far-seeing, and we also admired his openness to other Christians. I think once he gave a ring to an Anglican, that was, for us, it was most symbolic. It was almost revolutionary. So that was a very eloquent act. It meant taking them seriously as our fellow Christians with whom we want to prepare for that day when we will be reunited
as Christ didn't want two churches or three or four or 500, but just one. The fact that when he died, everybody agreed this was a great pope and a saint. Even the communists would be in favor that he should be canonized, so which is very good. And the other Christians would be in favor too.
One of the things he said when he was dying was that there's not a person that I met in my life that I didn't love. He was a very positive person who could find the good in people, even good in people who you would traditionally consider your enemies or on the other side of the fence. So he fit in with the spirit of the times very well. I remember his Pacem in Terris, his very famous encyclical letter, which again made a big splash. I mean, the New York Times, which was not known to be very favorable to the papacy, carried article on article about this really groundbreaking document. But, I mean, that's just one instance of all over the world. Even I remember the communists in Moscow reacted to it, which was, flabbergasting. We couldn't believe it, that there would be some reaction. In fact, they came to call the peace priest movements in the satellite countries, Pacem in Terris, those priests who were collaborating with the communist regimes, they called them Pacem in Terris in commemorating the encyclical of Pope John the 23rd. It was a very broad encyclical, how we should foster peace on earth. And it was broad enough to include many things. And I think everyone could resonate with the basic premise that he had at the beginning, that if you want peace in the world, it has to begin with peace in your heart and the peace in the heart of every individual. And I think that resonates with many people, not just Catholics or Christians or even religiously oriented people. That's why I do think that he hit at certain basic truths that many people could agree with, even if they weren't particularly religious. I think that's what made him so popular.
Si impegna a fare speciali intenzioni per ciascuno di loro, le vostre mogli, le vostre sorelle, le vostre...
Well, I do hope you enjoyed part three of this series of features focusing on the figure of Blessed John the 23rd, 50 years on from his election to the See of Peter. And finally, time to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, respecting our weekly rendezvous. To watch the change of tone. Does one translate then globalization of human concerns?
You're going to have to say studiorum humanorum unum compactio, something like this. A driving of human concerns into one. That's not so bad. To get the idea of what you mean by globalization, coactio, the forcing humanorum studiorum coactio in unum, into one chunk. In fact, we did this in the Pope's encyclical, and I said the driving of the world industries into one. Compulsus or compulsio industriarum in unum. You're squeezing all industries into one entity. That's globalization. You have to think of what you're talking about. Globalization doesn't mean anything, you know. I could say globalizatio. Of course, globus in Latin means a sphere. So to spherify everything, what does that mean?
Heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.